The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very, very good morning. How are you?
Okay, Tov, pretty good. Thank you, Howard. How are you guys doing today?
Yeah, excellent. Not so well behaved, we're finding, but so we are relying on you to keep us a little bit more sensible, if you don't mind.
I don't think that that's a good idea, Howard, I'm afraid.
Well, we're going to give it a shot.
I think you're relying on the wrong people here.
Hamas prisoners in Israeli prisons have ended their hunger strike. That's after announcing that all their conditions have been met. All right, do we know what the deal that has been struck contains? What is it?
Well, we don't know the details, and there's a lot of speculation about a white flag having been put up by the prison authorities, because when you hear the words "all conditions have been met" being made by prisoners, it sounds as if though the authorities have capitulated and given in to everything that they requested, whatever that might have been. But this whole hunger strike has been quite a strange event, because originally the hunger strikes were called in the prisons quite some time ago, and then they were delayed and they were delayed again, and there was no real understanding as to why they should have been delayed if they've called the hunger strike and if they were so serious about, you know, protesting against the conditions that they found themselves in Israeli prisons. Then why didn't they just go ahead and just initiate the strike? In the event they didn't initiate the strike, it was delayed, delayed, delayed. And then eventually the hunger strike was begun. But of course, inevitably, quite a number of the prisoners were found to be eating secretly while the strike was supposed to be going on. So it didn't seem a particularly serious strike in terms of how hunger strikes ought to be conducted.
It sounds like all of us on a diet. Yeah, yeah.
Very, very strange. But we know that the main issue that they were complaining about was this issue of the prisons being surrounded by this call blocking technology that Israel had deployed in order to prevent prisoners from using mobile phones that had been illegally smuggled into the prisons. I mean, I'm still kind of trying to get over this whole concept and why the Israeli authorities would actually then come to some sort of an agreement on the matter. We understand that there was an agreement reached in terms of which public phones would be made available to prisoners for them to use. So they will have access to the outside world through these public phones. And apparently the prison authorities can also then record and listen into the conversations that they're having on these public phones. Now, if it was me, I would have said, we will give you public phones and the call blocking technology remains, which means you can only use the public phones and you cannot use any of the smuggled in phones to the prisons. And I'm not sure that that's exactly what's happened, but that seems to have been the most logical thing to me. So I'm not sure whether the call blocking is still part of the Israeli prison system or not. Unfortunately, there were some prison guards who were actually quite badly injured, who were stabbed in altercations that took place within the prison system. And so obviously there was quite a big incentive for this issue to be resolved and to try somehow to reduce the level of tension that was going on within the Israeli prison system as initiated by these Hamas prisoners. But the point is that they seem to have a relatively easy ride in Israeli prisons, especially when you consider the type of treatment that has been dished out to Israelis who are imprisoned by Hamas people in Gaza. We think of Gilad Shalit and others who had no access to the Red Cross and who were kept in very, very poor conditions indeed, had no access to the outside world, call blocking technology or not. So, you know, by comparison, these guys seem to have a relatively easy ride. And of course, Israel is very much signed up to the Geneva Convention, which means that Israel will abide by the most basic rights that are afforded to prisoners in Israeli prisons under the terms of the Geneva Convention. And I think that they've certainly got that and probably a lot more.
Yeah, it's actually a completely ridiculous situation that, I mean, there can't be a prison in the world that, that simply just allows people to have free use of cell phones, especially ones that have been smuggled in. It's in a complete absurdity. There's a strange story that I wanted to ask you about that, and I'm seeing it all over social media, but I don't know what is real and what is not real. And, that is the rumors about returning the body of the famous Israeli spy, Eli Cohen that is set to be on the way home for burial. Is this true?
So we have heard rumors. Nothing has been confirmed. It's even been reported on Israeli TV that this might be the case. The government representatives, the security establishment, are not responding at all. They're not denying it, and they're not confirming it. Now, you know, one could therefore read something into that. The fact that they at least are not denying it, but I'm not sure that we can really, you know, come to any conclusions about that. But, you know, we know that, the body of Zach Baumel was recently, returned to Israel for burial after almost 30 years of having been, in Syrian captivity, having been buried in Syria. And of course, the Russians were very helpful. The Russians, who caused us a lot of aggravation, in Syria, have actually come up with some quite helpful things in spite of, you know, the tensions that we've had with Russia over their presence in Syria. But this is clearly one of the things that's really worked in our favor, is that they've helped us to locate the body of Zach Baumel, and he's been returned home for burial. We spoke about that last week. And that has, in a way, given some speculation to the possibility of other bodies being returned home. There are a few bodies which we understand are in Syrian possession, buried somewhere in Syria, including that of Eli Cohen. And in fact, his widow, who's now 83 years old, was quoted as saying that she had this really bad feeling because his name is not on the list of those who are missing in action. When you look through the official list that Israel publishes of Israelis who are missing in action, Eli Cohen is not one of them. And the reason, I think, is because he wasn't really part of the IDF, and the names that are on the missing in action list are really soldiers of the IDF. But I suppose one could very, very much understand her point of view when she says, even though he wasn't officially a soldier in the IDF, he was representing the State of Israel via the Mossad. And of course, we know that he did some incredible work in Syria before he was finally captured in 1965. He befriended and built very close ties with business and military and government leaders. He became the chief advisor to the Syrian defense minister. This was an Israeli spy who had been born, an Egyptian Jew, was born in Egypt, was sent to Syria for the Mossad to gather intelligence, and became the chief advisor to the Syrian defense minister. You can't really get it much better than that. Unfortunately, as we know, he was captured. A wonderful book was written called Our Man in Damascus. There's a movie that's either come out or due to come out about the story, which I would encourage people to see, because, you know, the story itself is fantastic. Unfortunately, he was hanged in Martyr Square in Damascus back in 1965, and the Syrian government retained his possessions and his body. They never allowed his body to be repatriated. His widow is now 83 years old, and she actually personally appealed to Bashar al-Assad a few years ago, saying not only to him but also to his father, where she personally appealed, saying that she's getting old, and she sent photos of her children and grandchildren, asking if he might release Eli's body so that he can be buried in Israel, which is really what he deserves. And in fact, even last year, the Prime Minister's office managed somehow to retrieve a watch that had belonged to Eli Cohen, and this watch was presented to his family. It's not clear exactly how the watch came into Israeli possession, but I just wonder whether, again, it's not part of the help that the Russians are giving in order to try to help Israel to relocate some of these people. So, an interesting story. There's absolutely no grounds of confirmation, nothing at all that we can put our hands on to say it is really real. But there's just a lot of rumor, and you know, inevitably where there's smoke, there's fire. And it is certainly my hope that finally, after all this time, since 1965, that Eli Cohen will finally be returned and will be able to be laid to rest in Israel, which I think is richly deserved.
By the way, just one other
story before you carry on. There was a story about the fact that he convinced the Syrians to plant trees on the Golan Heights around their various fortifications, and those trees helped Israel 2 years later in the 1967 Six-Day War to actually capture the Golan Heights. So he had a legacy even 2 years after he died. The things that he had been busy with and convinced the Syrians to do actually helped the Israelis during that war. And I think that that's a fantastic, fantastic piece of the story.
And hopefully this is true, that he is, that his body or his remains at least are on the way back. I've just started reading the new Mati Friedman book, which is called Spies of No Country, I think. Spies of No Land. No, Spies of No Country. It is absolutely incredible, and it talks about, some of these units, and it was, the spies in inverted commas who came from, Arab countries and Arab areas, and how they were trained and went back to many of these areas in order to facilitate security for the State of Israel. Absolutely incredible book.
There can be no doubt at all that people like Eli Cohen and many others who are much less famous and some of them who are completely unknown have really made an unbelievable contribution to this country's security, and certainly, especially in the early days, but even now, are doing an incredible job in terms of gaining intelligence information, which is so valuable to Israel in allowing Israel to not be responsive and not be reactive, but be proactive in defending its borders and making sure that Israeli citizens and, of course, the State of Israel doesn't come to harm.
Absolutely. And Israeli technology has been chosen for the construction of the world's first electric road in Sweden. What is this project?
So this is really an unbelievable story as well in terms of Israeli technology and know-how. We know that Israel has become more and more at the forefront of self-driven vehicles and electric vehicles. And now it's being taken a step further by actually electrifying the road so that when an electric vehicle is driven on the road, it's receiving a constant charge from the road in order to allow it to continue. So of course that means that the whole idea of having to plug vehicles in order to get a charge will not be required. And this whole change of battery thing. I mean, the biggest challenge that faces the electric car industry today is that of how far the vehicle can actually drive before it needs to be charged and how long it takes for the battery to be charged once the battery has been run down. Those are really the two main challenges, and this electric road will hopefully resolve some of those issues. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how commercially viable it is to build the road, because obviously there's a huge cost involved. But Israel's Electrion Wireless has been chosen to build this stretch of road. I think it's going to be something like 1.6 kilometers of electric road that will be part of a 4 kilometer route that connects Visby Airport on the island of Gotland in Sweden to the city of Visby. It's a very small city, 24,000 people, but obviously the Swedish authorities are using this as some sort of a pilot in order to prove the technology and to prove that this is something that's workable, because ultimately the Swedish have it in their minds to really build out a huge electric road infrastructure in Sweden to enable the use of electric vehicles. They plan to implement something like 2,000 kilometers of electric highway across their country. And that plan is estimated to be worth something like $3 billion. For now, at least, this little project that's being put together by a small publicly traded Israeli company called Electrion, which is headquartered in Beit Yanai. It's one of the global leaders in what they call dynamic wireless power transfer, which means it installs a copper coil technology underneath the road. It's invisible to road users, but it just allows a steady electricity flow to be received by the vehicles on the road. And apparently they're going to be shuttle buses that will use this technology, as well as some electric trucks that are going to be evaluated using the stretch of road. So it's going to be fascinating to see. Electrion already has an agreement with the city of Tel Aviv and Dan Bus Company to try out a 1 kilometer stretch of road in Tel Aviv, also as a trial in order to prove the technology. And of course, if that works, then I guess the sky's the limit for Electrion and for the a real change in the way that electric cars are operated these days.
Yeah, it's amazing. I just keep thinking what would happen here in South Africa with load shedding. Wow. Wow.
That would be, that would be interesting. Fortunately, Sweden and certainly Israel doesn't have the same sort of problems with load shedding. But it is an interesting problem though, because, you know, what people are saying is that it's all fine and well to, to stop the use of petrol. And I mean, this is really all about trying to prevent the use of petrol, not only for cost, but also for environmental reasons. But then you move on to increasing the use of electricity, and so therefore the requirement to produce more electric power becomes obvious, and how that electric power is produced and whether that might have environmental and cost considerations, that of course is a discussion for another day, but it's an interesting one nonetheless.
Absolutely right, Anton Reich, that's where we leave it. Thank you as always, fascinating and up-to-date Israel report. We'll chat to you tomorrow, same time, same place. It is 8 o'clock. Here's your news with Zanat.